There are trailers at YouTube under Patchwork Films. I encourage you to look at it. I encourage you to order the DVD. I'll tell you all about it when I get back, maybe during tomorrow's show or later tonight during the horn section. In the meantime, stick around for a rerun of this past Monday's show. I hope you all enjoy it. And like I said, we'll catch you for the horn section. Back in a little.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Somehow or another, that seemed like rather a long weekend. Or maybe it was just the idea of finally feeling good again and not being consumed in the malaria sweats or whatever of the great flu of '08. But it's good. Oh, my goodness. It is good to be back this Monday evening here on the East Coast. I guess 3 o'clock on the West Coast and, oh, goodness me, something like 10 in the morning where Horn Chief Engineer John Fox is hard at work in Sydney, Australia. Global broadcasting at its very finest, coming to you from the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful West by God, Virginia. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. And I'm inclined to do a little reminiscing for a moment, if you will. As you know, I grew up in the last petered-out foothills of the Appalachians in North Alabama, of West Virginia stock. We never quite got out of the mountains. My family didn't, even though they did move. And some of my earliest memories are of, and it's because I'm a part of the television generation, among the first generations to grow up with a TV in the house from the moment that baby arrived home from the hospital. I am a part of that generation for good or ill. Probably ill. Nonetheless, I did grow up with the electric box in the house. And quite frequently, my dad would be gone off to work or on his way home from work when I, as a little child, would get up and saunter into the living room and on into the kitchen and get a bowl of cereal or whatever my mother prepared for me, and I would watch television in the morning. From 7 to 8, The TV station I was most prone to watch was out of Huntsville, Alabama. WHNT-TV-19, a CBS affiliate. It was watching that channel and the evening news when Walter Cronkite would be off somewhere and someone else would cover for him. That someone else was usually Roger Mudd. And I may have told this story in the past, but when other grown-ups were fond, and maybe they still are, I don't know, of asking little children what they wanted to be someday. And most of the little children I grew up with, little boys, I want to be a fireman, I want to be a policeman, I want to be a soldier. The question was put to me, and the answer I came up with was, I want to be Roger Mudd. I don't know why. I saw there was something about Roger Mudd and the way he delivered the news that spoke to me. And, of course, as I said, it always came over WHNT TV Channel 19 out of Huntsville, Alabama. Such being the case, well, 7 o'clock, saw one of the local guys, a fellow by the name of Grady Reeves, with a show, local origination, called Morning Folks. And it was a wrap-up of the local news from the night before and the farm report and drying conditions. Took me years to figure out what drying conditions were, and I may yet to this day not know exactly what drying conditions were, but it apparently meant a lot to the local farmers. But then at 8 o'clock, well, it was this. And that was the earliest television memory that I have. WHNT TV 19, Huntsville, Alabama, carrying Captain Kangaroo, Bunny Rabbit, Mr. Moose, Mr. Green Jeans, those strange little cartoons that twisted my mind forevermore. Krabby Appleton was one of them, I seem to recall, and I think he rubbed off on me more than any other Krabby Appleton. Ping pong balls falling from the sky, cheap shtick. And a real, a sense of attachment to a local broadcasting outlet on the part of a little kid, because that was always my favorite channel. It was my favorite news growing up. It was WHNT TV 19 that I tuned into as a kid coming home from baseball games in the mid-70s to sit and watch, early to mid-70s, to sit and watch the Watergate hearings. It was a sort of omnipresent thing in my world, WHNT TV 19, Huntsville, Alabama. I got a lot out of Captain Kangaroo as a kid. Far more than I think. Sesame Street never spoke to me. I had started school by the time Sesame Street came along. What is all of this about, you may ask? Why have I wandered off down memory lane? Well, for good reason, really. Because a lot of the good that I understood about the media, I got out of WHNT TV 19, Huntsville, Alabama, with towers atop Montesano Mountain. Talk about the last foothills of the Appalachians. There it is. And so, I was more than usually grieved when I saw the news breaking about 60 Minutes last night. Now, to show you what an unmediaized, just neo-maxi-zoom dweeby I've become, I didn't know until it was over that the Oscars were on last night. Whew. I mean, I guess I live in some sort of a media cave now. Me and... Well, you know, Bob Al-Kincaida and Osama bin Laden, you know, just, you know, off in a cave somewhere, not watching TV. I imagine Osama bin Laden probably watches more TV than I do. But anyway, so I didn't even realize that the Oscars were on last night. Travel Channel was running a bunch of Tony Bourdain reruns, and I watched a few of those. Very good. But I made a point at 7 p.m. of catching my local CBS affiliate for 60 Minutes because the Don Siegelman story was going to run. And as a consequence of that, I got a little bit better informed than I had been, and I've tried to follow the Don Siegelman story. And we talked about it. I talked about it with Carolyn Kay from MakeThemAccountable.com a little bit on Friday evening this past, because I've not made a lot of mention of it, simply because it is Byzantine, and well, I guess that qualifies me as lazy to a certain extent. Don Siegelman is without a doubt the most high-profile political prisoner in the United States. Don Siegelman was buried by the Republican Party and the Bush administration because he would not get in line. Early on, he became one of the first governors to openly say that he would not support candidate Bush in his run for the presidency in 2000. And laid out in this CBS 60 Minutes expose was a clear indictment of the politicization of the United States Justice Department by Karl Rove and the Bush administration. And it was laid out fact by fact by fact with an expert former prosecutor to comment all along the way to explain what was wrong with the prosecution. And it was damning. Among other things, if you think, for instance, about old Scooter Libby. Irving Scooter Libby was convicted by a jury of his peers and never was subjected to any sort of humiliation before George W. Bush could grant him clemency. On the other hand, Don Siegelman, whose actions were not even arguably criminal, shamelessly political, but not criminal, the instant that the jury returned the dummied-up, faked-up, frauded-up, ginned-up verdict against him, the right-wing, repig-licking federal judge who had tried the case immediately had him clapped in manacles and hauled off to prison without so much as the usual 45-day get-your-crap-together, get-your-stuff-in-order period of time that is afforded almost every criminal defendant who has been convicted on a white-collar basis. He was not allowed to remain at large pending his appeal. He was, in fact, shuttled away and stuffed in a hole where hopefully he would learn his lesson about crossing the Bush family. I would imagine this segment may have actually made it to YouTube by now, for all I know. If you have not seen it, I highly encourage you to make the effort to do so. It was an indictment of dirty, deep southern Alabama politics at its very, very worst. And now we get around, after all of this as prologue, we get around to why I was reminiscing, to why I took that little trip down memory lane, to why I began having the Captain Kangaroo theme run through my head all day today. Because, you see, if you want to watch CBS in North Alabama, you have to watch WHNT-TV-19 out of Huntsville. And that means, if you look at the map, probably as far south as Cullman, and from east to west of Alabama, you're watching WHNT if you want CBS. So, Florence, Decatur, Muscle Shoals, Tuscumbia, Sheffield, Russellville, Red Bay, Gadsden, Arab, Gunnersville, Cullman, all of them would have been tuning in to WHNT TV 19 Huntsville last night to watch the Siegelman expose on 60 Minutes. There was only one problem. It didn't run. It did not run. It also didn't run down Mobile Way in the boot heel of Alabama. A black screen replaced the broadcast during the Siegelman segment of 60 Minutes. And only the Siegelman segment of 60 Minutes. Fully one-third of Alabama was deprived, deliberately, of the opportunity to see just how vile, just how filthy, just how dirty, just how utterly, undeniably corrupt their loathsome Southern Baptist-run government is. That's right. Alabama Governor Bob Riley, who was running for re-election against Siegelman was beaten in the primary. But he was the one who, in conjunction with the Bush administration, did everything humanly possible to destroy Don Siegelman. And all of the information there about that whole event, as it was contained in the 60 Minutes segment on Siegelman, was black screened last night by WHNT TV 19, Huntsville, Alabama. And then it came back. When the Siegelman segment was over, a button got pushed because the boss called and said, "You can turn it back on now." Larissa Alexandrovna over at Raw Story has done an excellent job covering this, and she has also covered it in further detail at her blog called At Largely. She writes, "I now have confirmation of Channel 19 going to black screen during Siegelman's part of the 60 Minutes broadcast." And she said WHNT is claiming, "We apologize that you missed the first segment of 60 Minutes tonight featuring the prosecution of Don Siegelman, because it was a technical difficulty in New York." Meanwhile, CBS in New York said CBS in New York told Scott Horton, who has also covered this in detail, quote, "There is no delicate way to put this. The WHNT claim of technical difficulty is not true. There were no transmission difficulties." You see, there's not just one line that runs from New York to WHNT-TV. It goes up on the bird, it comes down off the bird. Obviously, the CBS affiliate in West Virginia was able to get it. CBS affiliates all over the United States were able to get it, except in the Soviet Socialist Republic of Alabama. Scott Horton, with his blog at Harper's, says, "I am now hearing from readers all across northern Alabama, from Decatur to Huntsville and considerably on down, that a mysterious service interruption blocked the broadcast of only the Siegelman segment of 60 Minutes this evening. I contacted CBS News in New York and was told that there is no delicate way to put this. The WHNT claim is not true. There were no transmission difficulties. The problems were peculiar to Channel 19, which had the signal and had functioning transmitters." Horton also says, "I was told that the decision to blacken screens across northern Alabama could only have been an editorial call." Okay, that seems obvious enough. Now, why would WHNT-TV19 do that? Who owns WHNT-TV19? Well, unlike the days of yore when I, a little kid in his footy pajamas, would get his toasties or whatever and sit down to watch Captain Kangaroo as a child on WHNT-TV19, Huntsville, Alabama. Unlike then, Channel 19 is now owned by Oak Hill Capital Partners. Sounds like some sort of private equity fund, doesn't it? Well, whatever it is, Oak Hill Capital Partners is owned by the Bass family of, come on, you know it, fill in the blank, it's easy, Texas. The Bass family are, of course, heavy, and when we say heavy, we mean lots of money, lots and lots of money. Heavy contributors to the Repig-Lickin' Party and dear friends of the Bush administration. Well, howdy-do. Just in case you're wondering, let's see. If you want a zip code, zip code for the broadcast reach of WHNT-TV19 might be, oh, how about Florence, Alabama, 35630. Maybe you live on Cypress Mill Road. And maybe you're really pissed. Maybe if that's the case, you want to contact Rhonda... Got to get glasses. Rhonda Barnett. Barnett. Rhonda Barnett. B-A-R-N-A-T. You can contact Oak Hill Capital Partners through Rhonda Barnett at 212-371-5999. That's 212-371-5999. That is, if you, you know, care about things like not living in an increasingly Sovietized state. Is there any wonder left that as to why some of us keep talking about the desperate need for media ownership reform in this country? Is there? I suppose that's a rhetorical question to you guys. Don't think that this was a decision that was just made. No. The Bass family of Texas, I am certain, had some help. The Bass family of Texas, I'm sure, got a phone call. Maybe not from the White House, but from free agent provocateur Karl Rove, perhaps. Calling up and saying, you know, we don't want to run that. That makes me look like some sort of criminal thug. Well, Carl, that's what you are. I know, but we don't want people knowing that now, do we? So what was it George Bush used to say, that he needed to catapult the propaganda? Consider the propaganda catapulted. I got up this morning and read this story and I was simply astonished. Once again, it was like having that little, you know, 5-year-old me taken out behind the barn and just horsewhipped for a while. Yeah, I do make those kind of connections. Maybe it's silly that I would, but I do. because all of that is all wrapped up in what it was to be the kid who had my childhood, who would later become the guy who's sitting behind the microphone right now. And it feels like betrayal. And it feels like something gone. And it's also interesting, insofar as that little corner of Alabama from whence I come is the last bastion of any kind of Democratic Party strength in the state. Northwest Alabama still votes fairly routinely for Democratic candidates and sends Democrats to the state house. And now, granted, even those Democrats have to say, oh, I'm a family values conservative. But they are at least Democrats. And so I find it particularly interesting that it was blacked out for them, for people who might have been motivated to really get up on their hind legs for a change and make a ruckus about it. But you can't make a ruckus about what you haven't been permitted to see. Why are Oak Hill Capital Partners Limited and the Bass family allowed to have a broadcast television license for Huntsville, Alabama, when they operate in Texas? Why are massive media conglomerates owned almost exclusively by right-wing apparatchiks and operatives allowed to control what Democrats, Republicans, and even anarcho-syndicalists can see in this country? What commonality of interest does a conglomerate out of Texas or North Carolina have with the recipients of broadcasts over the public airwaves of North Alabama or anywhere else other than where they are? And bear in mind, we're talking about, in this case, the public airwaves. Granted, most people probably got their transmission, their black screen, if you will, by cable. But first and foremost, these television stations are over-the-air broadcasters. The kind of TV you can still get with an antenna. And as such, and that's very, very important, because as such, they are squarely and thoroughly within the regulatory purview of the Federal Communications Commission. Granted, that FCC is hopelessly bemired in Bush administration crony politics, sure. But there's a possibility that that nightmare will end in about 9 months. Kind of like waiting for a baby to be born, isn't it? Waiting for the November election. So let me use this as a moment to reiterate how important this election is. Mark Levin, our dear friend, and I think among the finest talk broadcasters in the country, bar none, terrestrial, internet, or otherwise, spent an hour talking about Ralph Nader and the return of St. Ralph. And I share Mark's feeling on this. Being a fan of Warner Brothers cartoons, I think there would be a great deal of poetic justice if a big piano would fall on Ralph Nader's head. Or an anvil, maybe. Or if he'd stand on some promontory and the promontory would just go and fall away, as though Ralph Nader were some sort of American political version of Wile E. Coyote super genius. I loathe Ralph Nader. to put to use a term frequently used in the South, I wouldn't piss in Ralph Nader's mouth if his damn guts were on fire. But he's back, and he'll have plenty of pig-licking money to get out there and raise mesmerize just enough progressive left-leaning Democrats with things like, well, there's really no difference between John McCain and Barack Obama, or there's really no difference between John McCain and Hillary Clinton, so you might as well piss on your own vote and vote for me. Just enough of them to maybe give us John McCain in the Oval Office. And then you and I, we won't have to worry about any correction or clarification of conglomerated media ownership rules in the FCC, now will we? John McCain, Ralph Nader says that the reason he's running is because, well, nobody out there, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, aren't talking about the issues that really, really matter to progressives in America. Bite me, Ralph. You want to talk about those issues? Get busy in the Democratic Party. Because you're not speaking a language that repiglickens even understand. You'd have to, I don't know, maybe if you go out there and start offering a magic cookie once in a while to go with your reform message, maybe they'll listen, or, you know, rub some Crisco oil on somebody's head, or mutter in tongues, or drink some strychnine, or handle a serpent, or roll on the dang floor. But Ralph, you don't really care about that, do you? No. No, Ralph, you care about making sure that this country doesn't even have any hope left. You care about making sure that John McCain gets into office so he can make sure that the door not only gets slammed shut on progress and hope, but that nails and rivets get driven in to keep it tightly closed forevermore. God, I wish somebody would give Ralph a nice brand new cherry Corvair. Send him out to drive on some wet mountain roads. You know, there's been a lot of talk of late accusing Barack Obama's followers of having a cultish quality. I don't think I buy into that. I really don't. But if you want the definition of a cultish politician, you need look no further than Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader was the original cultish politician. In fact, if you go back into the mid to late 70s or so, you'll find a book by one of my favorite modern authors, Tom Robbins, called Still Life with Woodpecker. And Still Life with Woodpecker centers on one protagonist by the name of Lee Cherie Furstenberg Barcelona, otherwise known as Princess Lee Cherie. And she has dirty sex dreams about her hero, Ralph Nader. A key plot point of the novel involves her flying to Hawaii for the Global Eco Awareness Conference in hopes of meeting her crush, Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader is the origin of cultish politicians. He is the poster child for cultish politicians. You want a cultish politician, go and find, and they're still out there, by God. They are still out there. Go and find a Nader follower. and you will see the sort of glassy look of the Hare Krishna or the Muni when you look in their eyes. You don't get that talking to a Nader supporter. So it all begins to come together. Media ownership rules that have allowed a corporation of a family from Texas to control what North Alabamians watch, to keep those North Alabamians from learning a little bit of the filthy truth about Republicans, Republican politics, George Bush, Karl Rove, Bob Riley, a rotten federal judge, an even more rotten federal prosecutor, and the state of Soviet-style politics as practiced by Republicans in both Washington, D.C. and Alabama. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Yeah, Christian from Moscow.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Fine, but I just called in to say I really enjoy listening to you, Bob, but I just think on Ralph Nader, we 100% disagree. The easiest way to throw the Democratic Party to the right is to be a committed voter. I'm going to demand things of them as if they don't deliver. I'm going to go elsewhere, and it looks like I'm going to go elsewhere because they're not giving me anything.
I think you're mistaken, Chris, because what Nader said in 2000 still reverberates inside my skull, that business that there was no difference between George Bush and Al Gore.
Al Gore won, but it wasn't Nader's fault. They would have stole that election anyway.
As Mark Levine noted, Chris, if only 7,000 Nader voters in New Hampshire, not Florida, in New Hampshire gone the other way, it would have been a different outcome.
Well, you know, they would have accounted for it. They stole the election. They weren't going to give it back. They weren't numbered. They'll just find another excuse.
Ralph Nader made it easier for them to do that.
Well, I don't think so, because I think the problem was Ralph Nader was a legitimate candidate, and he should have been given a legitimate opportunity to get his ideas out to the public.
Well, why didn't he do that then? Why didn't he work within the structure of the party that exists for those principles?
Peter Kirchhoff should on every radio station. You don't want competition. You don't have anybody on the outs. Look for American history. Always been the outsider who had turned the policy.
How many third party presidential candidates have ever won the presidency?
None, but they had quite an effect on the president.
Who?
Wallace, for one.
Yeah, that's a negative. Henry, that's a negative Wallace. Effect. George Wallace. Yeah, he had a negative impact on
Henry Wallace.
Oh, Henry Wallace. Okay.
George.
Okay. Eugene V. Debs was the largest vote getter of any third party politician.
And he had quite an effect on American politics.
And got prison for his troubles too.
Oh, I know, just like this governor in Alabama, the risk to taking a stand. People won't like you if you take a stand, if you try to with the dialogue.
All I know, Chris, is that the same thing will happen in 2008 as happened in 2004 and in 2000. And that is that the Republican Party will give great deals of money to Ralph Nader in the hopes that he can siphon away just enough progressive votes in just enough important states that they can sneak the Republican in under the wire.
The Republican, they have stolen politics. They're not about to give it back. You don't see that. We don't have real elections in this country. And somebody got to stand outside and broaden the dialogue. And I'm glad Ralph is running. I think Ralph is a hero.
Not anymore, I don't. Not anymore. I used to have a great deal of respect for the man, but at this point, he's little more than a tool of the Republican machine.
Why don't you have him on? Why don't you talk to him?
Because I'm not going to give him any publicity, Chris.
Yes, see, there you are. We don't have the right to vote. We only have the right to vote for the party you want to win.
No, not at all.
Yeah, that's just what you said.
No, I don't give free publicity to people who are trying to hurt America.
He's not... Well, that's your opinion. That's certainly not mine.
He will look when we get. The consideration is easy here. Will America be better off with John McCain as president following George Bush?
I don't know.
Well, for me, that's an easy call. John McCain will be a disaster. John McCain will be a disaster of a president. He will be an unmitigated disaster of a president.
I agree.
Ralph Nader is making it more likely that we will have President McCain.
Okay, then if all you want is a Democratic Party, you have to appeal to the right because he's already got you be my guest.
Well,
don't make any demands for mountaintop removal. Oh no, I can't do that. I gotta.
No. That's the whole point, Chris. I and others like me are actively trying, desperately trying, to change the Democratic Party from within because we know that the constitutional structure of this country is not such that it admits for the viability of a third party.
The Democratic Party is going to the right because they've got you already. They don't need.
No, they don't have me already. I've got a list of people I don't vote for. It includes people. It includes Robert Byrd. It includes Jay Rockefeller. It includes my member of Congress. I have very few people that I vote for as a Democrat, but I do actively work within the party to bring us back to our center-left roots.
Well,
I'm doing what the Democratic Party desperately needs. I am working inside the party to bring it back to its senses. Because I realize that Ralph Nader and his third partyism is little more than peeing in a corner.
Well, I think under our system, Ralph Nader has the right to run, and
I agree. He does have the right to run.
Well, if he feels he could, Lord bless him. I only wish he would be heard by the public. That's how you change this country, by changing the dialogue.
But you know who needs to hear him, Chris? I agree. I like the issues he talks about. Let's have no misgivings about that. I like what he talks about. I think he talks about some very valid points. And you know what? I'd like to see him standing on the stage behind the podium in Denver in August of 2008 telling Democrats to get out there and demand different. But no, Ralph doesn't want to do that because Ralph wants his ego stroked instead of changing America. He's not about changing America.
It's part of it, but it's part of the problem. We can go round and round, but somebody got to broaden the dialogue.
I agree.
Nobody's doing it. Talk radio, they say we have 9%. I don't believe we have 9%. We have whole communities, major cities in the United States without a single... liberal or progressive on the air. Well, they have 4 or 5 stations that are for so-called right-wingers.
Oh, yeah.
4 hours a day.
Right.
But we won't have any change in that with McCain as president.
Well, no, I don't think we will with Obama either. Maybe Obama might be marginally different, but only marginally different.
How broad would the margin have been between Bush and Gore in 2000, Chris?
Can I ask you a question to answer? Who started the war in Iraq? It was Clinton.
No, it wasn't.
Remember the no-fly zone?
No. The war in Iraq was started by George Bush the first.
No, it wasn't. It was started by Clinton. They called it the no-fly zone.
No. Chris. Now wait, doggone it. I love our conversations, but they have to be done on a factual basis. The war in Iraq was begun by George H. W. Bush in his presidency. And there was no Clinton before George H. W. Bush. That war was begun with the so-called invasion of Iraq, which was dummied up and ginned up and faked up.
That's right.
And so that's where that started. Now,
that was an unwar,
and it was dirty, and it was vile, and the UN sanctions were filthy. So are you saying that the last 8 years would not have been any different had we had Al Gore as president?
I don't know. That's an imponderable. Probably would have been a lot different. We probably would have had 9-1-1.
I think we wouldn't have. Hey, Chris, I enjoyed the conversation, but I think you and I have very different opinions of Ralph Nader. And
can we get along to go along? We're so friends, aren't we?
No. What I'll say is you and I will agree to disagree.
Okay,
I don't go along to get along with my own party.
Well, look, he's running for president. It seems to me that it's an obligation to hear him out. That's all I'm saying. You don't have to back him, but you got to hear him out.
Well, I'm sure he'll be heard somewhere.
Well, probably not on the mainstream media. NPR.
Chris? What are you talking about? He made his announcement on Meet the Press.
That surprised me, I must admit.
You can't get any more mainstream than that now, can you?
That's true. However, nobody watches me play
that, though. All right.
Good talking to you.
Okay, you have a great evening, Chris. Take care.
You too.
Bye now.
Bye.
And onward. Let's see. Okay. Hi, who have I got?
Oh, you've got David in Middle Tennessee.
Oh, hey, David. Long time no talk to.
Precisely. This one absolutely pulled me up from off the sofa. Oh, my gosh. I didn't even pour a fresh one to get on the radio for this. Let's make this into a bumper sticker. Let's make this so apparent that the argument will absolutely come to a flat stop. Anything we take away from the Democratic Party's ability to elect the president in this November is a direct line to another goddamn Alito. Can we just be clear about that one stinking fact?
Oh, Jesus, please? You just made the little hair stand up on the back of my neck. Yeah, another...
Just stop talking about good ideas about foreign policy. Yes, Obama is a corporatist. I am nervous, but I think he can be spoken to and swayed. If any Republican gets in, it's going to be on the blood-sworn, satanic oath that another... God, I want to say fucking so badly, I'm going to say it anyway.
And you just did.
God damn it, will we please acknowledge one bumper sticker fact. Republican means another Alito, and we are in the 1880s in a heartbeat. All right, now I'll settle down.
Well, I would just assume you didn't, David, because you're right. I don't like the triangulation that I have to do every 4 years in a presidential election. And I don't like the fact that it seems like I never get the candidate that I want. But you know what? Well, yeah, when the little kid who watched Captain Kangaroo on Channel 19, later in the day he would ask his mommy why he couldn't have the Batman utility belt, and she would say, because you've already told me, son, that when you get it, you're going to try to jump off the roof. Okay?
Did you break anything when you did?
And I never got it.
Oh, darn.
The truth be told, Agnes bought me and Ferg matching Batman utility belts two Christmases ago.
Oh, Lord. Now, that's a stroke of genius.
Oh, it was. It was. And she was so proud of herself because it came as a complete surprise. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm used to being disappointed.
Oh, yeah. For the last 25 years, for sure.
I mean...
Except for that Christmas.
Yeah, kind of, but... So, you know, I wind up choosing between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, neither of whom were my first choice. And I have to pray that somewhere in the backroom dealings that John Edwards is having a positive impact on the two of them. If you listen to them, it sounds like he has. I hope it's not just rhetoric.
I don't think there's any doubt. I'm sorry, I see conviction in the face of John Edwards. I see that man sticking with it. I don't see that man going away. It's just that his message had such a large hole in the road to fill, it's going to take him multiple elections to fill it up and then drive over it to somewhere where the country really needs to go. And I am sure, oh, man, I'd love to have the phone charges between everybody else in the Democratic Party and John Edwards' cell phone. I'd like to have the bucks that went into that.
Yeah, baby.
No, but he's been charging that thing three times a day.
Oh, he's probably got a bank of them.
Yeah, probably.
But, you know, right now, and I, David, I hate it. I wish we could talk about the candidate who's going to bring us all Frisbees and wheat checks.
I don't want Frisbees and wheat checks. I want some troops coming home. I want something to dispel the damage, displace the damage in NAFTA, and I want something resembling an honest tax code. And, you know, maybe Hillary, maybe Obama, but they're certainly going to be closer than McCain. I mean, that...
Wow, and you just did that thing you do so well. You just opened the door.
Oh, Lordy, I'll never get to say another word. Go for it.
Well, yeah, you will, because you just did something, David, that I think should not be, it shouldn't just kind of go toddling by. One of the things, and I'm not gooning on Chris, okay, I love my conversations with him, and I love the passion that the hardcore left-leaning progressives, whatever the hell that means, so, like I'm a centrist.
No one has greater reverence or an idealist than I, nor you.
Okay.
So let's start right there.
But one of the things was that Ralph has to be listened to because he'll bring his ideas forward. Why does it have to be Ralph? Why is Ralph the anointed one who is the only one who can talk about our issues? It seems to me that Dennis Kucinich talked about them all during the campaign. Edwards talked about a lot of them. Mike Gravel is crazier than a run-over dog, but he's mentioned a few of them. But more important...
We have a winner. Look, oh, please, bring this man the nice toaster. You just won it. Those same ideas. Kucinich, Nader, those guys could get along. But did America buy it when Kucinich said it? Nope.
No.
Not quite ready for it.
Now, I'm gonna upgrade from the toaster to the toaster oven with this one, David. It is far more important. It is far more important. I cannot emphasize how much more important it is that David from Middle Tennessee, or Sue from Ohio, or Dave in California, or Ben in Illinois, or anybody out there who is a real on the ground, bust your ass, get your hands dirty, and rip holes in the knees of your pants, liberals, talk about it. Screw Ralph Nader. Screw Ralph Nader to the wall with a
with a concrete bit, okay? To hell with Ralph Nader.
If he gives a full and fair opening of his books, he's going to find, it may be laundered, it may be disguised, but you're absolutely right. There's going to be a boatload of Republican money giving him the opportunity to do whatever he chooses to do from this moment forward. And I absolutely, you know, to the fates, to the gods, you know, I'll hug a tree till dawn. Getting back to my Druid roots, to hopefully have the same trend that occurred in 04 based on 02. His influence in 04 was negligible. I hope it's less than that now. Fine. Obama's got a cult. Let the cult never even hear Ralph Nader's name. Ugh. And I'm not too keen on cults.
No, nor I. But the point I think is the importance of what is very clearly a growing movement in this country, and that is progressive values being discussed and demanded by extraordinary Americans who carry this country on their back every day. When working America gets up and starts talking progressive politics, it's a hell of a lot harder to dismiss us as a group than it is to dismiss a Ralph Nader or a Dennis Kucinich or a John Edwards. We're what matters. You're what matters in terms of changing the dialogue.
And I want to offer a little ray of hope. Here's a teddy bear. Here's a ray of sunshine. Let's go skipping. And you've been in my town. I have seen 3 Obama stickers on white people's cars in Portland, Tennessee. Give that some thought, Bob.
Don't take long. That means something.
You bet your ass it means something.
You know,
and it isn't on my car, but it will be soon.
Yeah. As soon as we have a nominee, that sticker is going on my car. You know, because that's the, oh boy. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and it is important. It's as important in Tennessee as Alabama because for once there might be a shot. There might just be a shot.
And for those listeners around the world, I live in Sumner County. I live 4 miles from the Kentucky state line. This is not glitzy Nashville. This is not around some university.
No, it's farm country. It's, yeah.
The county seat is Gallatin. It's way, way south. I live in a burg of 8,000 folks. And they go home. They go to work. That's about it. Tons of churches, all the rest of it. And there's Obama stickers in my town. That's a very big deal to me.
Well, the fact that that means that there's some sort of an Obama operation in Tennessee.
You bet there is.
And that's important because of the previous and you know, the Terry McAuliffe DLC approach to Democratic Party politics of, well, we'll win Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, we'll win 10 states and lose 40 and hope we get the presidency out of it. And to hell with liberals and progressives who live below the Mason-Dixie line, they can go to hell.
Were I diagnosed with a terminal disease, which I am not wishing for, he's one of the people on the short list I would present myself to, and one of us would leave the room. Oh, I despise that man.
And see, that's the thing. There are Obama operations in Alabama, in Georgia, in, yes, Mississippi. And that means a possibility of beginning. Come November, if Obama is the nominee, I don't expect him to win Alabama and Mississippi or Arkansas. But I expect him. But I expect him to mount a credible campaign there. And mounting a credible campaign there means all the difference in the world. It means a beginning. And I'm not. This is not the starry-eyed, you know, ooh, you know, Frisbees and Wheat Checks part of the candidacy program. No, but it is about a beginning of reunifying this sharply, sorely divided country. Because we are divided, and I think you'll agree, David, won't you? We are divided at this point in time as much or more than any other time since the Civil War.
I agree. Kennedy's presidency came really close, but I think it's worse now. I really do. And I was 19 when Kennedy was killed, so I feel like I was able to judge, be a fairly good judge of that sort of thing. And it's divided on purpose, and Rove did it.
Yeah, this didn't happen by accident. Rove did it,
Nixon did it,
the Southern strategy, yeah.
You know, things are alive again, Bob, that I thought were in the grave with a wooden stake in their heart. There are people burning churches. There are people burning other religions' places of gathering down simply because they heard Michael Savage call them bad people. And that's a big generalization, and it's a huge jump, but I know it figures in. I go to a grocery store in my town here, Portland, Tennessee, and there's a guy that I can see about every 3 weeks with a Savage Nation baseball cap on. And it hurts me when I see that. And I know there's no talking to that guy. If he's bought into that, I'm not going to dissuade him. If he says something to me, game on. I'm not going to walk up and say, "You sure about that hat, Flick?" No, it wouldn't work. If he starts explaining to me the glories of Michael Savage, like I said, game on. But I'm not going to, I won't engage him in conversation.
Well, I did. Yeah, and there's a distinction there that matters. But the idea that there's some sort of a counterbalance to that growing there, that is even more profound.
Yes.
Well, David, thank you very much. I can guarantee with mathematical precision what's going to happen every time I mention St. Ralph. And daggummit.
There are those that see him as a saint, and they will never see him otherwise. You know, to draw a really goofy musical analogy, it's like guys that say Jaco Pastorius is the only bass player that should ever be talked about, or that reggae is the only music that it should ever be listened to and cared about. I'm sorry, once they've tumbled for Ralph, I'm sorry, they're like Moonies. They go right past the practicalities of what he has done and what he has said. I hearken back in this wonderful, even-handed Ralph Nader documentary where a guy that worked for him for 20 years congratulated Ralph on 9/11, tax cuts that didn't matter, and all the rest of it, because he chose to present himself in an ill-timed manner for a poorly thought-out goal. Sadly, that was 2002. His influence was much less in 2004. I hope his influence now is only to spend Republican money on ads that go nowhere. That would be a gift from, you know, all that's powerful. But we'll see. And you have other callers, and it's time for me to settle down. And again, I apologize.
Time for the fresh one.
Oh, I'm sorry?
Time for the fresh one.
See ya.
All right.
Don't go changing. Let's do lunch.
All right. I'll have my people call your people.
Please do.
Later.
Bye.
Our good friend David in Tennessee. We'll take a break. Come back. Your calls. Well, shoot. Light them up. 304-658-3333. Or on our nickel, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice, America's listener-supported Liberal Voice. This is The Horn.
Starlight and magnolias, starlight. light in your hair, all the world a dream come true. Did it really happen? Was I really there? Was I really there with you? We lived our little drama. We kissed in a field of white and stars fell on Alabama that night. I can't forget the glamour. Your eyes held a tender light, and stars fell on Alabama last night. I never planned in my imagination a situation so heavenly, a fairy land that no one else could enter, and in the center just you and me. Dear, my heart beat like a hammer. My arms went round you tight, and stars fell on Alabama last night. All right, let's take it on down from Muscle Shoals through Decatur. Birmingham. Right up over Spanish Fort into Mobile, my hometown. Mr. T. My imagination, a situation so heavenly, a fairy land that no one else could enter, and in the center just you and me. Dear, my heart beats like a hammer. My arms went round you tight. All stars fell on Alabama last night.
One more time, boy.
Yes, we lived our little drama. We kissed on the dunes so wide. On Alabama last night.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
All righty, all set with my latest beverage of choice. You ever done this? Mix a little bit of sweet iced tea with some nice red grape juice? I'm trying to cut back on the cigarettes a little bit, so I'm opting for cigars. Got a humidor that I had back in the salad days that I'm trying to get back to. And trying to stoke up one of those during the show instead of, you know, the usual pack of cigarettes. And, you know, having a nice beverage with a cigar is just wonderful. And, you know, I promise that I won't, you know, get all loaded up and looped on the air like, you know, certain right-wing talk hosts who shall go nameless except to say that it's Rush Limbaugh. So, you know, instead of sitting here with a glass of port or God knows scotch or something like that, try to find something that'll go equally well with a nice stogie and a little bit of sweet iced tea. About two-thirds, one-third with some Welch's grape juice. Nice combination. Really nice. You know, the clean on the palate kind of thing. Yeah. So, yeah, that was my break. What did you guys do with the break? Or did you just say, yeah, I love that. Stars Fell in Alabama. I do. A couple of weeks ago when I was on the aircraft and my traveling companion and I were watching the display of safety features for the airplane that the attendant goes through, the flight attendant, before takeoff for every flight. You know, there's the sort of... They hold up the little plastic mask with the little bag and everything. I looked at my traveling companion and I said, yeah, like that works. I said, if there was a sudden depressurization of this cabin, that thing would probably fall out and there'd be cobwebs on it. After all, this is an American corporate welfare airline. And I didn't think any more about it, you know, just sort of... gallows humor, laughing in the face of death, getting ready to fly from D.C. to Charleston in a harrowing, nightmarish roller coaster ride, you know, flak over Bremen kind of affair. And then I read the story of Corinne Desir, 44 years old, flying back home to New York from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. 44 years old. That part just sort of grabs me. 44 years old. Had some heart trouble. And turns out that American Airlines they're doing their best to put as good a face on having somebody drop dead on your airline in mid-flight and finding out that your stuff didn't work as they possibly can. They insisted today that they tried to help Ms. Desir when she couldn't breathe after a relative had said that the oxygen and the defibrillator were both just dummies, that they didn't work. Desir had complained of not feeling well and being very thirsty on the Friday flight home from Port-au-Prince. This according to Antonio Oliver, a cousin of hers who was traveling with her and her brother, Joel Desir. And a few minutes after, a flight attendant brought her some water. She said she was having trouble breathing and asked for oxygen. And the flight attendant twice told her no. That's the point at which she turned to her cousin, Antonio Oliver, and said, "Don't let me die. Don't let me die." Other passengers aboard Flight 896 got agitated over the situation. The flight attendant, apparently after phone consultation with the cockpit, tried to administer oxygen from a portable tank and mask, but the tank was empty. It's So then two doctors and two nurses who were also aboard the aircraft tried to administer oxygen from a second tank. It, too, was empty. A nurse tried CPR to no avail. Then they brought out the portable defibrillator, you know, the Cheney unit. Tried to use it, but it was busted. And in the 45 minutes it took to divert the flight to Miami, Corinne DeSeer collapsed and died. Her last words, "I can't breathe." The FAA requires commercial flights to carry no fewer than two oxygen dispensers. That's for rapid cabin decompression. Now, the FAA requires it, but it's up to the airline to maintain the canisters. Because, you know, we wouldn't want to be regulating airlines or anything, seeing as how regulation's all communist. Wilson, a passenger, said DeSeer's cousin flagged down a flight attendant and said the woman had diabetes and needed oxygen, and the flight attendant responded, "Okay, but we don't usually need to treat diabetes with oxygen. Let me check anyway and get back to you." And she went and spoke with another flight attendant, and both went to DeSeer. And the situation was worsening. Wilson, of course, being Charlie Wilson, the paid flack for the airline. "Okay, but what is with you to treat diabetes with oxygen? Okay?" I'm going to stop making wisecracks about aboard aircraft, because I don't like finding stories like this that, you know, confirm my darkest gallows nightmare humor. Poor Antonio Oliver will not sleep well for a long time with the face of his cousin looking at him and saying, "Don't let me die." And at some point in the process, because people are people, and horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner could straighten me out on this or add some depth to this, but I'll just go out on a limb since I don't have him handy. Even if it's not your fault, your little soul makes you wonder and ask yourself in the dark and still of the night whether it was. It's natural. But it was not Antonio Oliver's fault. God, this is like the scene from Catch 22 where they reach for the medical kit to help help Snowden in the back of the aircraft, and they reach for the morphine syrettes and they find a little paper that says, "Courtesy of M&M Enterprises, what's good for the company is good for everybody, and everybody has a share," and the morphine's gone. Kind of makes you wonder if the oxygen tanks aboard this American Airlines flight had a sticker on them that said, "Because we didn't fill the oxygen today, American Airlines share prices will be valued at approximately 0.001% higher on our next quarterly stock dividend. Our lobbyists are also working to get more corporate welfare for American Airlines." God. It's another one of those moments where you ask yourself, what happened to the can-do nation? What happened to the nation that saw every challenge as an opportunity
to do better. We've been choked to death by our corporatism, haven't we? Well, we don't want to do a lot of R&D because R&D is expensive. It's and it doesn't do nearly as much for us as advertising does. After all, we can write off advertising on our taxes as a cost of doing business and have a very handsome, tidy little sum there on the quarterly report. Heartbreaking. Just heartbreaking. Meanwhile, headline, our good friend David in South Carolina sent this along. Headline, Obama photo in turban and robe causes stir. Oh, don't! This is from the Associated Press. It's been picked up all over creation. A photograph circulating on the internet of Democratic Senator Barack Obama dressed in traditional local garments during a visit to Kenya in 2006 is causing a dust-up in the presidential campaign over what constitutes a smear. The Drudge Report posted the photograph today and said it was being circulated by Clinton staffers. Yeah, sure it is, Matt. Sure it is. Now, bear in mind that if you do even the most cursory Googling, you will find photographs of George W. Bush, I think standing next to Vladimir Putin, probably having just looked into his soul again, at one of the Asian Pacific summits of early on in his first term, wearing a silk, some sort of silk Asian pajamas type garb, which was probably incredibly comfortable, but which on George Bush made him look like Ho Ho the Clown. You remember, don't you? I can't remember what color it was, but it had great big white dots all over it. Remember that? And I don't recall any websites at the time. Now, granted, liberal and progressive websites and people who despise George Bush did have some fun with the photo. How could you not? Because, as I said, it made him look like Ho-Ho the Clown. But I don't recall any websites questioning whether or not that clothing made George Bush subject to being queried for being a tool of what Flush Flimball refers to as the Chi-Coms. My friends, the Chi-Coms own the Clinton administration. And George shows up in traditional Asian garb, and never has heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not Muslim all day, or cloudy all day. You know, then there's the photograph of Hillary Clinton in some sort of traditional Muslim garb with a piece of cloth over her head, because in Muslim world, women are filthy and have to cover their heads. Can't see any more than a woman's face, don't want, filthy, filthy woman! Never mind. It's an Associated Press photograph of Barack Obama. He's wearing a white turban and a wraparound white robe presented to him by elders in Wajir in northeastern Kenya, Obama's estranged late father having been Kenyan. And Obama visited the country in 2006 and attracted a lot of well-wishers. Again, the Drudge Report says Clinton staffers are circulating the photo. Clinton spokesman Howard Wolfson, who has billed the Clinton campaign hundreds of thousands of dollars, said, I just want to make it very clear that we were not aware of it. The campaign did not sanction it and don't know anything about it. We weren't there, we didn't do it, and even if we did do it, we were only following orders. Okay, the last part was me. None of us have seen the email in question. If anybody has independent reporting that they've done on it, I would welcome it. Now, Obama responded by saying, everybody knows that whether it's me or Senator Clinton or Bill Clinton, that when you travel to other countries, they ask you to try on traditional garb that you have been given as a gift. The notion that the Clinton campaign would be trying to circulate this as a negative on the same day that Senator Clinton was giving a speech about how we repair our relationship around the world is sad. Well, I think Obama's probably assuming facts that aren't in evidence. Kind of surprising, him being a lawyer and all, but, you know, what of it? Because you and I both know where this kind of opposition research is coming from. Matt Drudge, yeah, because he's a reputable journalist. We're going to believe what he cites as a source. Because somebody's just going to send him an email saying, Dear Matt, hi. I'm a high-ranking member of the Clinton campaign, and I wanted to send you this salacious email with a photograph of Barack Obama wearing white East African robes so that you can put it on the internets and make sure that everybody knows that he's a devout Muslim who's going to take his oath of office on the Koran, just like those redneck ignorant women said in that video from Lynchburg, Tennessee. Okay, thanks. Great. Bye. Because the Clinton campaign's just really not that savvy. They just go out and do that kind of stuff, and sure. Oh, for pity's sake! It's going to be this all the way to November. Earlier in the program, I said it's sort of like waiting on a pregnancy, 9 months between now and November. And the question is whether we give birth to a little bit of hope for fixing a few of our problems, or whether we give birth to a monster all shiny and pink by the name of McCain. I personally, and I, you know how much I hate the word believe. But so with that caveat, I'll go ahead and say, I do not believe. I do not believe that the Clinton campaign was responsible for circulating that photograph. No. On the other hand, I saw a video last week, talking about video on the radio, there I go again, of George Bush in Africa dancing his little fool head off. Dancing his little fool head off in Africa and just looking like a real idiot. And it goes in the historical file alongside the picture of him in, what, Haiti, Jamaica, beating on some other guy's drums and doing the funky chicken, whatever it is that Bushes do when they're trying to find their inner sense of rhythm. This most recent video of George Bush was particularly funny, however, because there was, I saw it with some commentary by someone who identified themselves as African American, who said, yeah, there he goes, he's dancing. He's just dancing and thinking, man, if I just keep dancing, maybe they won't eat me. Whew. Mother. But we're going to worry about, the double standard. And look, I understand why the Obama people get a little bit pissed and a little bit touchy about this kind of stuff. Hillary Clinton's been in native garb. Bill Clinton's been in native garb. George W. Bush has worn every bizarre thing that Asia had to offer, because personally I think that since the rest of the world knows that George Bush is a moron more than some Americans recognize it, they see him coming. Ah, we are hosting Asian Pacific Summit. This is very good. Call the tailors. Tell them to get the costume this year will be the most stupid thing we could possibly find. George Bush will look marvelous in it. And you couple that with, remember the video of him trying to leave through the locked door in China? Couldn't pay to have this stuff written. Couldn't get away with it in a Hollywood movie pitch. But moving, so I understand when the Obama people get a little touchy, because when it's done with regard to Obama, it has a greater, it has a wider application, if you will, a broader subtext. Because on the one hand, if George Bush or Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton do it, it's oh, look, there's the white people putting on the native dress. Isn't that quaint? If, however, Barack Obama does it in combination with his name, you wind up with people like Ann Coulter out there saying, see, B. Hussein Obama's going back to his roots. The only thing you didn't get there was the picture of him kneeling on his rug facing Mecca and praying in his real religion. And I hate that stuff. God, I hate it. Because when it is applied to Obama, it does have a broader racial subtext. It is the Harold Ford ad with the jungle drums and the pale white blonde girl saying, Harold, call me. It's not quite the same as the picture of John Kerry windsurfing or John Kerry in the sperm suit or Michael Dukakis in the tank. No, because, again, there's an implication there that Barack Obama isn't as American as you and I are. You think I like talking about this way? I don't. This is depressing. This tells me, oh, Lordy, oh, this tells me how far we have yet to go in this country. And more immediately, it tells me how low we're going to go in this country, some of us, between now and November. And that is mighty low. Oh, mighty low indeed. So, you know, there's that. And while we're on the Obama thing, the poll question on the CNN website. If I was a diehard Obama supporter, I would swear that Barack Obama can't get a break. That no matter what he does, it's going to be offensive to someone. Because on the one hand, we already know that it's not okay to go to Kenya and put on a robe. Because then Matt Drudge blames Hillary Clinton and says, oh, the Clintons did it. And regardless of the fact that Matt Drudge has about a million right-wing contacts for every contact that he has inside the Clinton campaign. Matt Drudge says, oh, the Clintons did it. So it's not okay to wear a robe. Now, let's see. McCain. John McCain. What kind of ethnicity would that be? Oh, Scots? Scotch-Irish, perhaps? Is there a photograph out there of John McCain standing in a Scots or a Scots kilt with a firkin and a firkin. And the socks and the ugly shoes. Getting back to his ancestral roots. If there is, will the Drudge Report publish the photo? Will people across the country, especially in weird little cultish right-wing the religion industry churches, question his patriotism for wearing a kilt? Or will they say that it's cute and quaint how he got back to his roots? How he's acknowledging his Scots or Irish or what the hell ever forebears. I really hope he's not Scottish. That's a little bit more shame I'll have to bear. No, of course they wouldn't. Nobody would criticize him for that. But it's not okay to be African. Not in America. Oh, yeah, I know. The very thought of seeing John McCain's ancient 71-year-old bony knees peeking out from under a kilt is enough. Yeah, that's the 3 a.m. flop sweats. You're right, Gene. What is a proper Scotsman wear under his kilt? Absolutely nothing. Well, maybe Vicky Eisman will find that appealing, or maybe Cindy McCain, but I'll pass. So Barack Obama can't put on the robe when he goes to Kenya. He has to wear a Brooks Brothers suit to show that he's been properly westernized and whitified. But then he shows up in the proper Brooks Brothers suit looking all nice and dapper and whitified. And CNN puts a poll question up asking whether this is don't blame me. This is what was asked on the website. Quick vote. Does Barack Obama show the proper patriotism for someone who wants to be president of the United States? Yes or no? Oh! Ben Smith wrote about it. He's a blogger of some sort, I suppose. I've got to say, I've never seen a reader poll like this on a mainstream media website, or to be honest, a right-wing blog. This is currently on CNN.com. The question seems tied to a story in which he took a question about his patriotism. But it's odd to see the mainstream media drive a largely whispered question that none of his main named critics, Hillary McCain or the RNC, will touch. The Post, mentioning all this over at Crooks and Liars, has a photograph of Duke Cunningham pointing to his American flag lapel pin. Does Barack Obama show the proper patriotism for someone who wants to be president of the United States? And again, it goes back to those redneck ladies from Lynchburg, Tennessee, who said, you know, he won't wear an American flag pin, and he won't put his hand on his heart when he does the Pledge of Allegiance. Ugly, ugly, ugly. You know, does John McCain show the proper patriotism? That's the phrase, the proper patriotism for someone who wants to be president of the United States when he votes to keep us in Iraq forever and ever and ever. Does he show the proper patriotism when he says it would be okay with him for our people, our sons, our daughters, nephews, nieces, aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters, mommies and daddies to be stuck in that hellhole for another 100 years? Is that the proper patriotism, CNN? You know, this kind of crap has to hit CNN's website, and people like Glenn Beck just look up and go, huh, we're still winning! Not only do they pay me to be a right-wing flack, now they're starting to act like me on their website. Ho, 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 ho! Does Barack Obama show the proper patriotism for someone who wants to be president of the United States? All the way to November, it's going to be this. Yeah, the story coming from something in the CNN Election Center saying Obama fights back on questions about his patriotism. After a town hall meeting in Lorain, Ohio, a reporter asked Obama about an attempt by conservatives and Republicans to paint you as unpatriotic because he once failed to put his hand over his heart while singing the national anthem. You know, unless you have a stunning singing voice, I think not singing the national anthem is probably the most patriotic thing that most Americans could do. Obama replied that his choice not to put his hand over on his heart is a behavior that would disqualify about three-quarters of the people who have ever gone to a football game or a baseball game. Yeah, no kidding. Not to mention the fact that when most people do that, they put their hand over their left breast and not their heart anyway. I guess it's kind of over the upper lobe of their left lung, if you want to get right down to it, physiologically speaking, but never mind me for, you know, being obsessive-compulsive. Then there's the photo that I just got from ELO in the chat room that shows George Bush putting his hand somewhere long about his belly button. But again, we won't question George Bush's patriotism over that, because George Bush is nice and white. And his middle name isn't Hussein, it's Walker. Never mind that the Walkers have been a bunch of bloodthirsty, murderous bastards in their own right, probably similar to some other guy named Hussein. Whatever. So, you know, this is the long and dirty road. This isn't a dirt road. This is a mud road. This is a mud rut, sunken road that we are going to traverse all the way to November. And instead of and what do we got? What do we got? And, well, we're gonna have to not only traverse that muddy, dirty road of religious libels, blood libels, and racial libels. We're not just going to have to do that. At the same time, we're going to have to put up with the idiocy of the likes of Ralph Nader saying that there's no difference between John McCain and Barack Obama. And that's going to be pretty sickening, isn't it? I hope it gets your back up. I'm not telling you to run away from it. I'm not suggesting that you hide your head. I'm suggesting that you get your back up. That you keep your hands in a fist and you be ready to fight back, figuratively speaking. Because they're going to do the same thing to Barack Obama that they did to John Kerry, that they did to Al Gore, that they tried to do to Bill Clinton. They're going to do what Repiglicans do. They can't run a clean campaign. They can't run an honest campaign, because if you actually make Repiglicans talk about issues in plain English, it becomes screamingly apparent to everybody who's paying attention that they're poisonous, that they're out to kill Americans. Preferably poor ones. And that they are out to destroy everything that you and I hold dear, from the Constitution and the Bill of Rights forward. To the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Susan.
Hey, Susan. How are you, dear?
Just fine. I think by now Barack is probably wishing his mother had given him the middle name of Aloysius.
Epaminondas, you know, whatever.
Yeah. As to the patriotism thing, here's the ultimate comeback. And it's also the ultimate difference between him and McCain. When Barack Obama goes out to a rally, any kind of appearance, anything like that, he knows in the back of his head, somewhere, there can be a man with a gun. And he's putting his life on the line every time. Any campaign appearance can be his last breath. And if that's not patriotism, I don't know what is.
It's courage. It is damn sure courage.
Now, if you didn't care about this country, why bother to do it? Just simple. John McCain isn't under any threat of dying every time he sets foot out of his door. Barack Obama, yeah, given our history, he has to take that into account.
You know, it's interesting you would mention that, Susan, because I you know, we've talked about that in the past, and I almost regret having done so, having brought up the issue of Barack Obama's safety, Because lo and behold, that very idea has reached the so-called professional media. Saw a story today saying Obama supporters quietly worry about his safety.
Yeah, I know. I put it up on ChatTab. We are. Anybody, whether you support him or not, should be worried.
But you see, the article itself said things like one woman who says her mother prays for him, and she had to convince her to vote for him because she was afraid that voting for him would endanger his life. Blah 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's being turned around as a reason not to vote for Barack Obama.
Well, they can try. Ain't gonna work.
Well, trying is what they're going to do. Trying is what they're doing, and they're trying for all they're worth. Whether it's, Jesus, he's not wearing his flag pin, or, oh, my God, he's wearing Muslim robes, where's the rug, or, oh, he might get killed, we can't vote for him, we got to save Obama by not voting for him, whoo! It's a full-front war, Susan.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is. But...
I mean, do you realize that the Obama flag lapel pin thing made it all the way to real time with Bill Maher this last week?
Mm-hmm.
There's a right-wing Republican congressman by the name of Jack Kingston. He's from Georgia. I think this is the little punk who cried about actually having to go to work in Washington, D.C.
Oh, the poor baby.
he brought up the... Well, Barack Hussein Obama won't wear his flag lapel pin. What kind of patriot is he? I had the nerve to bring that up on the Maher show.
Mm-hmm.
Curiously, when he did, and I'm looking at a photograph of it right now over at Crooks and Liars, when he was saying this crap, he didn't have a flag lapel pin on, and him a member of Congress.
Oh, my goodness.
Do you follow Doonesbury at all?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the exchange a few months back with the big, pasty-faced, doughy, jowly, white guy congressman who couldn't find his flag lapel pin? And his wife says, well, dear, you can have the one off of your pajamas. And he said, my God, no, that's my casual flag lapel pin.
And that's so typical of them, you know. It's just,
It's a manifestation of the right wing and the Republican Party's predilection for going toward idolatry.
Yeah, they do.
It's not enough to, you know, we've all got to worship the flag and say the pledge, and we've got to put our hands over the top left lobe of our lungs when we sing. And we've all got to have a little idolized American flag lapel pin. Do I have to get a lapel pin for the little microphone, little foam rubber microphone condom that goes over my microphone here? Does it need a flag lapel pin on it? I'll have to talk with John Fox and find out if that could cause potential electrical difficulties.
Does this mean I have to get a little flag lapel pin and bow down to it 3 times before I can turn on my computer?
Absolutely. I think it would be very good for you to get some sort of flag sticky for it. Now, you wouldn't want it to be magnetic on your computer or anything, but
no.
Some sort of flag sticky. It's got to be flags everywhere.
Well, in my case, I do have a flag that we hang out. It's a great big one. We hang it out every holiday, quite often, every not holiday. But it's a very special flag, because the stars, although there are 50 of them, they're arranged in a peace symbol.
Ah.
There are flags, and then there are flags.
Sure there are. Yeah, the peace symbol just had a birthday. I forget, 50 years old maybe or something like that?
Yeah. So I'll be more than happy to fly that flag quite proudly. The other one gets turned upside down.
Well, that's the flag that's on our vehicles upside down. I've never been questioned on it, but
I deliberately get flag stamps, and everything that is has a stamp on it goes out of our house. The stamp is upside down.
I do the same thing. They haven't sent any humorless guys in dark suits with skinny neckties and skinny lapels and earpieces and no senses of humor yet, but they're working on it, I'm sure.
And as for Matt Drudge, I agree with you. I don't think this came from the Clinton campaign. Even they're not that fumble-fingered. I think it came from Drudge. Drudge, shove it up here.
I know. Mm-hmm.
I didn't say it. I didn't say it. I was good. Expletive deleted.
That's a good ninja. Good ninja.
Anyway, it's getting towards the top of the hour, so I will let you go on to your other callers.
All right. Thanks, Susan. You take care.
Love to everybody.
Thanks. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Flag lapel pins. Wouldn't you love to just tackle your average right-wing member of Congress and grab the flag lapel pin just long enough to look on back and find on the back and find "Made in China" stamped on it? God, that would be fun.
Well, this is we've got people wearing American flag lapel pins in China now. This is an attempt to bring democracy and freedom to the poor people of China.
What a loathsome bunch of beasts they are. Do they think that no one see? Yeah, we see the hypocrisy. A lot of people see the hypocrisy. They don't much care about that, though. Because they're convinced that if they can only motivate that not very sharp group of people who still manage somehow to have the vote, that will be enough. So, there's that. Yeah, we're moving toward the top of the hour. It's about 8 minutes till. And, what else is out there? Oh, let's see. There's no want of information. Coming back out of the top of the hour, I think we'll have to have a look at the update to the Obama security flap. I think that would be advisable. And a lot of other stories as well, not the least of, well, wait and see. Why not? And, of course, you know how this operates. You can have as much impact on what gets played as, or what gets talked about, what gets discussed, as I do, by a long shot. Flag lapel pins, I admit that's a little bit shallow. But God, you got to know your enemy before you can fight him. And I hate to use terminology like that. But I really do think that we're sort of compelled to do so under these circumstances, because the people on the other side, the right wing, the repiglickens, I'm tired of pretending that they and I have any commonality of interest whatsoever. Because the kumbaya crowd will always say, well, we're all Americans first, and we all want the same thing. No, we don't. I want an America that has a little bit of compassion. I want an America that realizes that it lives in the world and not on the world. I want an America that wants to be part of a global solution that creates the likelihood of a tomorrow, not an America that is the global problem. I want an America that cares about the working people who make the country go more than it cares about the lobbyists who go all over the country. I want an America where we do more than talk about being advocates for little children and fetuses, where we actually do things that advocate for them, as opposed to for the sake of the lobbyists and the corporatists feeding school children around this country millions of pounds of potentially tainted beef. Disease-ridden, feces-encrusted beef. Possible mad cow beef. All that's happened. You know, Rick Goodner and I had an extended discussion about that on the Horn Section last Friday night. It is a horror. And I've got to sit down with Agnes and figure out a way for us to start getting some answers, because that tainted beef from that slaughterhouse in Chino, California did get eaten by my kids. And God forbid I should find out that there's anything wrong with it that would make anything be wrong with them. Because then there's going to be some real problems. And those problems are all going to look like baseballs to me, which means my solutions are all going to look like ball bats. A little bit of horror being reported by the BBC. Maybe we'll hit that in the next hour, too. But for now, we'll run a little tune, check in on labor news, and come back with Hour 3. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice, America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. And it only goes because you provide the means by which it goes. We'll be back.
While digesting Reader's Digest in the back of a dirty bookstore, a plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on the window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag gal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag gal won't get you into heaven anymore. Join the Christmas Club, we'll give you 10 of them flags for free. Well, I didn't mess around a bit, I took him up on what he said, and I stuck them stickers all over my car and one on my wife's forehead. But your flag gal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag gal won't get you into heaven anymore. Well, I got my window shield so filled with flags I couldn't see, so I ran the car upside a curve right into a tree. By the time they got a doctor down, I was already dead. And I'll never understand why the man standing in the pearly gates said, but your flag gal won't get you into heaven anymore. We're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the for. And your flag gal won't get you into heaven anymore.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. At least 48 million Americans lack high enough incomes to realize the American dream of solid middle-class lives. That's according to a new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The report says 1 in 5 U.S. workers earn wages below a minimum middle-class standard. To get into the middle class, you have to have a good job, defined by the Center for Economic and Policy Research as jobs paying at least $17 an hour, with employer-sponsored health benefits and employer-sponsored retirement plans. Just under 1/4 of all U.S. jobs meet this definition of good jobs. The report calls for a new social contract in America to lift workers into the middle class. It includes reforming and enforcing wage and hour standards and making sure workers can exercise their collective bargaining union rights. The report also calls for developing new labor standards that include guaranteed paid sick days, paid vacation, and paid family and medical leave in the U.S., as well as true universal health care. Merger talks are all the rage in the airline industry, but where do the unions representing workers come down? Jesse Russell takes a look.
While pilots spent Thursday and Friday of last week trying to work out differences over a merger between Northwest and Delta Airlines, the International Association of Machinists, representing Northwest baggage handlers, said it would oppose the two players coming together. In a statement, the IAM said airline mergers traditionally hurt passengers and workers alike. The pilots at both airlines are represented by the Airline Pilots Association, but the sticking point on their end is how the seniority list at the two airlines will be combined. The union wants to make sure that the merger agreement benefits all pilots involved. Meanwhile, many of United's mechanics are represented by the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association. Joe Prisco, president of AMFA Local 9, told the San Mateo County Times that if the airlines try something bad for the employees, the unions will take the fight to the streets. Local 9 represents workers at a maintenance base in San Francisco, which the airline has said could be closed or reduced if there is a merger.
Jesse Russell has today's economic report.
Existing home sales fell to their lowest level in January since tracking began in 1999. That led to a drop in home prices for the sixth time in 7 months. The number of homes on the market at the end of January was 4.2 million, up more than 5% since the month before. The median sale price of a home fell by 4.6% in January, in comparison to the same time in 2007.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
Two minutes past the hour, a quick email, a query. Why don't these miscreants acknowledge that to display our flag as anything other than a two-dimensional representation with square corners is a breach of our long-established flag etiquette? It's only been in writing for decades and decades. A waving flag depicted by a Chinese pin is an affront on two levels. Insult twice over. It's true. Now, these same miscreants, good word, these same miscreants are the progeny of the same people who tried to sue over people wearing the flag as articles of clothing, on their, you know, butts on a swimsuit, that kind of thing. But they think that this is somehow tasteful, to pin it on their suit as a waving icon? Yeah, point well taken. Point very well taken. And another email rolling in that is lengthy, but I think is more than merited in terms of its contribution to the discussion. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. Yeah, let's have this for a minute. As we contemplate American flag lapel pins, this is worth it.
You will report to the stable tonight and every night at 1900 hours. And without that pledge pin! Do you understand?
Yeah. What is that? A pledge pin? Where Repiglicans are concerned, I think you could fairly say, yes, indeedy. That indeed what we are dealing with here is Repiglicans who wear American flags on their lapels as though it was some sort of a pledge pin. And that is offensive in the extreme. Now, this note comes from one of our Australian listeners, known to you in the chat room as the Angry Architect. Condolences, Bob. I write this as a friend to your country and its smart and connected people. Maybe I was riding a little higher, reflecting on a slight change that's occurring in Australia. Regardless, I write this as a friend responding to a friend in need and by no means trying to sound condescending. I once said in the chat room that change is inevitable, that it is inevitable that your country's politics will evolve into something a little less corrupt, fearful, oppressive, and basically itself out of the gutter. I said this will occur this election cycle as your politics could not sink any further toward rock bottom. He says, today I've changed my mind. If Hillary thinks by releasing a photograph that resembles Barack Obama appearing to look like Osama bin Laden is good for her campaign, then all hope is lost. If this is what it takes to win a nomination, then all hope is lost. Hillary knows that by releasing this photograph in this manner, the tide will turn to one of three outcomes. A, she will win the nomination, as this is further evidence to the bogus claims that Obama is a Muslim intent on destroying the United States government from the inside. This is an appeal to the stupid redneck voter who is completely bigoted. B, she will lose to Obama in a photo finish, but by releasing this photo will also sabotage Obama's campaign, resulting in a win to McCain. This is the burn all bridges strategy whilst she takes the cricket bat ball and stumps and goes home until 2012. C, she will lose and Obama will win because the American electorate is sick of dirty politics. This is the scenario in which the people rally around the attacked candidate to change the future for the good of the country. The third option is something I hope will occur, but I'm convinced will not happen. Like I said, if your political system cannot evolve into something that cares about the basic humanistic values, well, what's the point of continuing? If I were you, I would, for the first time in my life, really take the option of leaving the country to the UK, Ireland, Canada, New Zealand, or lastly, Australia. Water cooler conversations around the world say that your politicians and the people who pay attention to them are useless, evil, greedy, corrupt, completely screwed in the head, basically. Stop the fear, grow up, travel the world, and realize that you are not the greatest country in the world. Neither do I live in the greatest country in the world. The more I travel, the more I see faults with my own country as well. I want to reiterate that I really do not want this to sound condescending. I want to come across that I wish you a better path, not to kick you while you're down. If I would like to kick anyone, then it's not the average voter. It's the people in the House of Congress. Unfortunately, you must realize that your foreign policy reflects on the country's people. If you want to know what the world's population is thinking about you, you can't handle the truth. It's going to make you cry tears of blood. If I can only hope for one thing, it's that I'm wrong, that the third option will come out and you'll be saved. I, for one, cannot visit your country en route to my former home of Canada. From the display today, I cannot step foot in your country whilst as a visitor or transit passenger. From now on, I travel via Japan or New Zealand. Bob, you're a good mate, and your listeners are good people. Please don't take what I've written as an attack on you, your country, or its citizens. If I've offended anyone for what I've said, I'm sorry. It isn't my intention. I want to be the friend who pulls up another friend when they've hit the wrong path. Whilst I know an email will change nothing, I need to have my say mainly because a telephone call really isn't an option for me as I'm at work during your show. Good luck. I wish you all the best, the Angry Architect. I don't know where to begin with something like that, because it's all true. The only thing I take issue with is the idea that it was, in fact, Hillary Clinton who pointed out the existence of the photo. It was an Associated Press photo. Anybody with a search engine could have found it. Now, why? Because it's Drudge. That's why. We trust Drudge. Drudge, who a few years ago was claiming that Bill Clinton had an illegitimate African-American baby hidden away in Arkansas somewhere, that Drudge? Since when does Drudge have any credibility? And secondly, as I noted, since when would a Clinton staffer send that to him and admit to being a Clinton staffer? That's the kind of opposite world disinformation that the Rove campaign, the Rove people are notorious for. I've got another email here that says, this is from our buddy David, who originally sent me the story, David in South Carolina. I'd say that Rove is doing this to split the Dems and pit us against each other. Notice right on the heels of the Nader announcement. Piss off some Democrats, and they go to Nader. Here we go. Those of you video gamers, okay? I didn't realize it until I was talking to my son-in-law the other day, him being a little bit younger than I. There is apparently a rather popular video game out there called Roller Coaster Tycoon. And I got a video. Oh, I'm doing it again. A video from some website somewhere calling itself How to Abuse Roller Coaster Tycoon. And apparently in Roller Coaster Tycoon, you build roller coasters. Go figure. I don't get Dance Dance Revolution either, or Guitar Hero, or back in the day when we walked uphill both ways to the video arcade to play Defender and snacked on mustard sandwiches. It's pretty straightforward. You fly from left to right and you shoot the bad things. But now we have video. There are American Idol video games, and I saw one of those and it was just like, because that's what America needs, more bad singing in the home. It's bad, not bad enough to watch people doing it and humiliating themselves in public. We'll do it in the home. But anyway, Roller Coaster Tycoon, you build points or whatever, and you get to design roller coasters or something. And in this particular video that I saw, someone had designed, you see the crowd, you know, it's like a theme park. You know, there's always a line 19 miles long to get on the roller coaster. And so there's that line of people waiting to get on the roller coaster, and then it cuts away to a first-person view of the clackety 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 clackety. You're in the roller coaster car, clackety 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 clackety, climbing up the hill, clackety 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 clackety, and you get to the top of the hill, and then, and you know, for the first-person view and the graphics and everything, it really does give you that sort of the stomach-lifting sort of effect of starting the downhill, and then so down the hill and around the curve and swoop, swoosh, and then you the camera pulls back and it's you realize that the roller coaster cars come down around the curve and right into the crowd of people waiting, and it just rips through the crowd standing in line to get on the roller coaster. There's explosions, and at the end there's some little kid's voice going, "Yay!" Why did I bring that up? Oh! Because this is the roller coaster that we're going to ride for the next 9 months. And the sad thing is, that roller coaster is sort of like the video that I saw. Because it's not over, and you don't step up out of the puke and get out onto dry land, and you're just grateful to... I don't ride roller coasters, so I don't get it in the first place. You saw what a total sissy I was flying from D.C. to Charleston. I don't get it. I don't like to go fast and be afraid that I'm about to die. I don't get a thrill out of it. I think there's something desperately wrong with me.
I like to sit around and be happy to be alive. But, you know, that's me. So I don't think the Hillary campaign was the one that released the photograph. AP released the photograph, truth be known. But this is the kind of Rovian stuff that the other side... have we forgotten the lessons of the Nixon administration? Now, you know that I don't like to use the fun words. One of the fun words got used... But the Nixon, and this is journalism, this is a journalistic reference. The Nixon administration pulled those kinds of political dirty tricks where they would do something really sleazy about another candidate and make it look as if someone besides the Nixon administration had done it, and it would stick, and the stupid, stupid, stupid professional journalists would go, oh, okay. And the Nixon administration had a term of art for doing that kind of thing, and the term of art was rat fuck. The so-called Edmund Muskie Canuck letter was a rat fuck. Sorry, it just was. I mean, that's just the name of it. That's what they proudly termed it. But I agree with the angry architect that we are in trouble, and I think it would do us a hell of a lot of good to take a long look from the outside looking in at America. Greatest country in the world? We can't even clean up after a hurricane. We lost thousands to a hurricane when a little country like Cuba gets hammered and loses nobody. We can't even clean up the aftermath of the hurricane. How many times does our pal Kate have to call in from the Mississippi Gulf Coast telling us what all is still broken? Greatest country in the world? My ass. We're fast approaching most pathetic so-called first world country in the world. Pitiful. On the other hand, we do not do ourselves any services by thinking that the problems are isolated with us. Case in point, story breaking at the BBC. If it proves to be true, this is a nightmare. This is audio of a news report from England. I'll let it speak for itself. I hope. Assuming that it plays. Nah, it's not going to play. Nonetheless, there's a print version to go with it. And the print version is... well, just as sickening. From the Times Online... The British Attorney General was urged on February 22nd to call in Scotland Yard to investigate allegations that British troops tortured and killed a number of Iraqi civilians seized after an ambush at a checkpoint in southern Iraq in May 2004. There's a couple of British lawyers by the name of Phil Shiner and Martin Day. And they claim that there's evidence from Iraqi doctor's certificates following examinations of 20 bodies that the bodies had been mutilated and that there were signs of torture having taken place. They cited two cases where Iraqis had an eye gouged out or pulled out and another where a penis had been severed. Oh, look, we're rubbing off on people. Day and Shiner are lawyers for five Iraqis who were detained by soldiers and held in a military camp at Abu Naji. And they came out with basically narratives of their witness statements for the first time on the 22nd. The Iraqis said they were laborers working in the fields who had been swept up in a 3-hour battle after a British convoy was ambushed by the Shia al-Mahdi army at the Danny Boy checkpoint near the town of Mazar al-Kabir. They said they were beaten and abused, and that they heard screaming through the night of May 14th and 15th, and shots that they believed were the sounds of Iraqis being tortured and killed. I never heard anything like that sound before in my life. It shocked me and filled me with such terror, Atiyah Saeed Abdel Ezra said. Now, the two lawyers said they didn't know for certain whether Iraqi civilians had been tortured and killed at the Abu Naji camp, but it appeared likely. And they implored the Attorney General to take the case out of the hands of the military and to put Scotland Yard in charge of a new investigation. Whether it happens or not, we don't know, but at least you can make that, request in the UK still. The Ministry of Defense has vigorously denied the allegations and said that the 20 Iraqis all died during the Battle of Danny Boy and that the injuries were consistent with the battlefield wounds. And said, no bodies were ever mutilated. Hussein Jabari Ali, age 28, however, said, the soldiers pushed me to the ground and handcuffed my hands behind my back. One soldier punched me repeatedly in the face. The blows were heavy and painful, and I was almost knocked unconscious. I was hit hard behind my left ear with a rifle butt and kicked in the back by more than one soldier. This treatment lasted for approximately 15 minutes. Hussein Fadel Abbas, age 24, said, at the Abu Naji camp, I heard the terrible sounds of someone being choked or strangled. The sound was really loud and unmistakable. Almost immediately afterwards, there were 4 to 5 shots fired in the room. This from Ahmad Jabbar Ahmoud, age 27. The soldiers were shouting at me. When they came close, I raised my hands in surrender. They circled me, and one of the soldiers kicked me with his boot in my back, and I fell on my face. Another put his boot on the back of my head and ground my face into the earth. This caused my face to be cut. Atiyah Saeed Abdel Reza, 22 years old. Whichever way I turned, they would kick me full in the face. This went on for a long time, but time itself seemed to stop for me. The blows just went on and on and on. I felt I was surrounded by and in the hands of absolutely merciless men. And finally, Mahdi Jassim Abdullah, age 21. I sensed that there were shifts of soldiers with different soldiers whacking me. If my head fell to one side, if I dozed off, I would get a bang to the back of my head. Oh, look, sleep deprivation. But luckily for us, that's not torture. It has to end. The Iraqi-occupation has to end. I can't imagine why there's any debate about this. I think I did mention we had a little right-winger wander into the chat room the other night. And it just... They're so hard to find anymore. That when you see one, you just sort of, it's like looking at some sort of zoo creature, because it's so bizarre that you can't imagine they're still out there, these people who think that the occupation of Iraq is a good thing. But they are still there. And you know, of course, that John McCain has said that he doesn't mind if we're in Iraq for another 100 years. The McCain-Turian candidate said that some... weeks or maybe a couple of months ago. Yes, indeed. Well, now, like Bush before him, now McCain needs to... Well, you know how it is with the Bush administration. It's all about clarification. Needs to clarify that 100 years business. Check this out.
One standing ovation from this line. We will never surrender, and they will, and I want to assure you of that.
But as defiant as the likely Republican nominee is about staying in Iraq, new evidence that McCain realizes the political battle against Democrats who want troops home now will not be easy.
What would be some benchmarks as far as progress in Iraq?
When a voter asked about Iraqi progress, McCain used the opportunity to clarify a controversial remark he made in...
I didn't know the word would be used. I really didn't know the word would be used. Clarify. Ha! Ah, they're clarifying.
Early January.
And by the way, that reminds me of this 100-year thing. My friends, the war will be over soon. The war, for all intents and purposes, although the insurgency will go on for years and years and years, but it'll be handled by the Iraqis, not by us.
This, when asked how many years the U.S. will be in Iraq.
Maybe 100.
We've
been in South Korea. We've been in Japan for 60 years. We've been in South Korea for 50 years or so. That'd be fine with me, as long as Americans are not being injured or harmed or wounded or killed.
Democrat.
So now he says the war will be over soon. But he also says that Democrats want to surrender. That's the part I really don't get. That's the part that's tough for me. This Democrats want to surrender business. Who is it that they expect us to surrender to? That's not a smart-ass question. That's the problem with this war and this subsequent occupation. It's not the kind of war that comes to a nice, tidy conclusion. It's an occupation. It is a late 20th century, early 21st century war. And there isn't a surrender. And there aren't any lavish, lovely ceremonies on the forward gun deck of an aging battleship. It doesn't happen that way anymore. God forbid we should actually take note of that. But there won't be a surrender. However, if by manipulating the language, the right wing can get the American electorate into a position where they equate ending the war with surrendering, and ending the occupation, more importantly, war schmore, it's an occupation. The Repiglicans have to equate the sane end of the occupation with surrender in order to keep this nightmare going. John McCain's in the unenviable position of riding a tiger. You know, you got it by the ears and you got it by the tail, and then all you can do is hang on and hope. He has to continue it, the occupation, for 4 years, or possibly 8 if he gets reelected. He can't even breathe about ending the occupation, because then he'll have another right-wing insurgency on his hand. Oh, there's that word. He'll have a full-on Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, Neil Bortz, hissy fit on him. And you can tell he doesn't much care for those. This is potentially a real quandary for somebody like the McCain-Turian candidate. So now he has to start, flip-flopping. But the war will end soon. And then the Iraqis will all do it for us. Well, how are the Iraqis ever going to do it for us if we don't leave? I guess that's just one of those inconvenient
things that McCain doesn't want to deal with. By the way, that reminds me of that 100-year thing. My friends, the war will be over soon. The war, for all intents and purposes, although the insurgency will go on for years and years and years, but it'll be handled by the Iraqis, not by us. Really, John? We were told, though, that it was mission accomplished way back in May of 2003, though, weren't we? I mean, that's when the war ended, wasn't it? That's when the occupation began. Let's not talk about war anymore, John. Let's talk about when the occupation ends. Now, granted, I understand that a dead American soldier lying in the heat of Iraq in the desert smells just as bad as a dead American occupier, so it's a distinction without a difference in some quarters. But the inquiry still has to be had. The discussion still has to be had. Or at least one would think that it does. And for the soldiers who aren't killed, who are merely maimed, wounded, and shattered for the rest of their natural-born lives, and have to spend time at, say, oh, I don't know, Walter Reed Army Medical Center. The staff there are working very hard on doing a better job. This is a real screamer. It was posted on the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com website earlier today. 50 medical workers, doctors, nurses, therapists, and administrators among them, sat in a room at Walter Reed Army Medical Center gazing at a slide. You know what our friend David from Middle Tennessee said about, you know, I jumped up off the couch and I ran to the phone. I didn't even bother to pour a fresh one. Well, sort of imagine that the Jeopardy theme's going in your head and take a minute and go pour a fresh one. You're going to want it. Then come back and sit down, set the glass down where, you know, you can't hurt it from kicking because, you know, it's a shame to waste, you know, good whatever it is you poured a fresh one of. And sort of grab the sofa or, you know, put your blankie in your mouth to cover the screaming or use your favorite cushion or whatever. Okay, all set? Good. 50 medical workers, doctors, nurses, therapists, and administrators among them, sat in a room at Walter Reed Army Medical Center gazing at a slide of Donald Duck on a screen. The oft-cranky Disney cartoon character, wearing his blue sailor jacket and cap and no pants, was in a palpable rage. His webbed feet had lifted off the ground, his beak was gaping, and his white-gloved hands were tightly clutching an old-fashioned two-piece telephone. You know, the kind they used at Mr. Drucker's store there in Hooterville. Quote from Chris Lafferty. Who's Chris Lafferty? Why, Chris Lafferty is a trainer for the Disney Institute. He's been brought in, and Disney has been paid a buttload of money to lead workers at Walter Reed in a 4-hour seminar on customer service. Chris Lafferty of the Disney Institute. Who knew there was a Disney Institute? Said, "We can clearly see he's frustrated. Why do we think he's frustrated?" No, really. God, there are some nights I get behind the microphone and share stuff with you that I wish I was making up. This is one of them. A year after a scandal erupted over the long-term treatment of soldiers at the hospital,
the Bush administration administered army looked to Disney for help. Disney. That Disney. You know, the company that has its founder's head frozen cryogenically somewhere. Service Disney style. That's what they call it, really. Can't make it up. Service Disney style is newly required for all military and other government employees at Walter Reed. Every single person. But that's okay. Because, among other things, Chris Lafferty and her fellow Disney trainer Mike Donnelly, well, when you go to your Service Disney style seminar, they'll give you little figurines of Mickey Mouse and Goofy. And they ask people to try to figure out why Donald Duck is so damn mad while he's holding the telephone in that photograph. That's right, we have paid Disney to give PowerPoint presentations to the people whose job is to ameliorate the miserable, hellish effects of the war and occupation of Iraq. We've Disneyfied the maiming of the American military. Various theories were offered for Donald Duck's ire. He was getting the runaround. He could not get a question answered. He was flummoxed by his antique phone. What's the lesson? Well, for the class that day, at Service Disney style, was that poor service equals frustration. Yes. At the tables, heads nodded in agreement. It's a little odd, but it's true, said Rear Admiral John Metexen, commander of Joint Task Force overseeing military medicine in the Washington region, Colonel Patricia D. Horoho, commander of the Walter Reed Care System, said the goal is to change the culture there. Look, more management speak. If he's listening live, poor Eugene Finnerman is having an absolute conniption right now. We're changing the culture. This is a quote from Colonel Patricia D. Horoho. When you enter the hospital, we want it to be the best experience possible. Disney fits that. It's a small wound after all. It's a small wound after all. It's a small wound after all. It's a small, small wound. I don't think so! But wait. Wait. Hang on to that cushion. Disney's not doing this because Disney is a patriotic American corporation that has benefited immensely from being able to do business in both, Anaheim and Orlando, whose product has been snapped up in mall stores and video stores, who have preyed upon little children to make their mommies and spend money. I want the Disney cruise, mommy. I want the Disney cruise. Take me on the Disney cruise. I want to meet Goofy. No, Disney can't do it for free. Disney can't do it as a patriotic service to America. Hell no! This is Bushmerica, baby, where every corporation gets to try to make a buck. Step right up! This is the political magic kingdom, and there aren't any booby prizes. The Army. The Army is paying Disney $800,000 to, in the words of the Army, revamp attitudes at Walter Reed. Pardon me if I can't help noting that we don't necessarily need to revamp attitudes via a Disney PowerPoint presentation, because it isn't the attitude that is found wanting. It is the broken down, busted, terminally screwed up leadership of the Bush administration, siphoning funds off from the Pentagon, and God knows there's plenty of them, to give to the Blackwaters and the CACIs of the world. It is the understaffing and the underfunding of Walter Reed Medical Center that leads men and women in the medical records department to want to pull out their hair. They're at Walter Reed, for the love of God! They see the hell and the horror and the misery and the damnation of this war and this occupation. They don't need their attitudes fixed. They need help. Don't send them Chris Lafferty from freaking Disney. Send them another ward clerk. More nurses. More doctors. More certified nursing assistants. More janitors. More desk clerks. More physical therapists. More psychologists. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph! I can see this from a little hilltop in West Virginia, but the Pentagon thinks it's going to fix it by giving out plastic figurines of Goofy to somebody who's already overworked and underpaid, underbenefited, and treated like crap by their superiors? Somebody schedule a court-martial for Colonel Patricia Hero-ho-ho-ho. Somebody bring that stupid rear admiral before the mast. God almighty. $800,000 worth of Disney figurines. Because the Bush administration destroyed the medical health care system within the military.
Someday my doc will come.
Yeah. All right, let's see who's on the phone. Hi, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's that pesky guy from Tennessee.
Oh, okay. Welcome back.
Geez, sorry to be such a bother, but...
No bother.
This has two levels, Bob. First of all, I've got to tell a quick, looking at the clock, it's got to be quick, story. My best friend from sixth grade through the end of college in 1966... was part of ROTC, like I was at that time. He did all the right things, excelled, became an officer, certified, not just an ROTC guy. And he had some body parts blown off in Vietnam. And he came back and he went to Walter Reed in June of 1968. He was part of the battle for the Stone Citadel. And I borrowed money. I went downtown to Knoxville, Tennessee. I borrowed money from the equivalent of a check cashing outfit so that I could take the first scheduled airline flight I'd ever taken in my life to fly to Washington, D.C. to see a guy I cared about. And I got there, and he was being cared for in a marvelous way. I will never forget, there was every aspect of great care, but he was in a wooden frame bed in Walter Reed. And there were other men in this ward, and they were in much, much worse shape than my friend, and I spent about an hour with him, and I said, well, you know, I got to get back to the airport. Is there anything I can get you? And he said, give me two packs of Winston's and a quart of Jack Daniels. I can put the Jack behind the bedstead on a coat hanger that I bent. So, I had a little cash. I went out front. I hailed a cab in Washington, and I'm a total rookie. I got no idea what I was doing. But a man I cared about said he wanted them. So I got the quart a long time ago, because you could still buy Jack at quarts. Anyway, and I get the whiskey, I get the cigarettes, and I come back home. But at least I had the feeling that what I saw around me told me my friend, with some of his body missing, was in the best of care. And sure enough, he came through it. And because he was of a military mind, he managed to recertify himself as a combat-qualified soldier. And that's the background to hearing that our nation now, to teach people at Walter Reed what they need to do for service people that are damaged, is to call Walt Disney? The bottom line, streaking right through all of this, there's not a single word, there's not any indication that the guys at the top, the guys that assign promotions, the guys that give raises, the guys that give good positions and promotions, care anything at all about this Disney stuff. Those people at Walter Reed, they can sit there and nod all they want, but when they look up, they're looking up at people that say, hold down those costs, hold down those benefits, hold down what you give up in the way of money, because we've got to plow more money into making sure our troops, somehow we divert money to troops that can go over there. No. Those damaged guys, they can't fight anymore. Never mind them. Fine. Yeah, nod your head in the Disney class. Nobody up top cares what the response is to that. Nobody's going to give those people a promotion because they said yes to Mickey Mouse. How disgusting is this? I think you know.
I'm almost speechless. I was speechless when I first read the story, David. I was speechless. And it was an hour or so before the show started. And I knew that I needed that hour just to, and I knew that I needed more than that. That's why I didn't get to it until now.
You needed to walk it off, sort of.
Yeah, and the justification for this, the rest of the story, so to speak. Turns out they decided this was a good idea because the Washington Nationals hired Disney to give team executives and supervisors tips on how to keep fans happy at the baseball stadium. Because that's what a guy with no legs and a half a colon is. He's a fan. He's a fan of America, David.
Sadly, a verbose individual that has never been at a loss for words is now.
This Admiral Metexan?
No, I'm sorry, Bob.
No, I'm going to do it to you again.
Yeah.
You called in. This is not my fault.
All right, I asked for it.
Admiral Metexan said, Disney is, and I quote,
sort of a benchmark on how to work with customers.
Well, just
stop. Wait. That one's got to percolate down for a minute.
Not for me.
A guy with a stump, with half his face blown away, is now officially, according to Admiral Metexen, a customer.
A C word. Well, this is it.
How much longer before they're consumers?
Oh, Bob.
Healthcare consumers.
Oh, God. You had to go there. Well, gee whiz, let's offer them choices. How about a healthcare lockbox? How about... I'm sorry.
Disney often encounters questions about its relevance to hospitals and other institutions.
People will joke about a Mickey Mouse operation. We generally have to inoculate against that with the audience.
Inoculate or inundate or just completely overwhelm them with, you know, things out of a cow's butt?
One of these people who are leading the seminar started working for Disney in the summer of 86 as a guide at Disney World's Jungle Cruise ride.
Oh, baby.
We're going to kick it off today with what we call sizzle. Here it comes.
Oh, my Lord. You know, I retired a year... Sorry to be personal, but I retired a year and a half ago because I had become completely... and irrefutably disgusted with the every 3 years there was a new set of verbiage, there was a new way to confuse the grunts that did the work into thinking they mattered, there was a new way of contriving some sort of fake involvement that the people that had to grind it out and sacrifice themselves for the good of the buck, you know, actually mattered, were cared about by those above. And like 8 years ago, I figured out, you know what, this is just, they're just rearranging this furniture to confuse all of us.
Oh, I'm so glad you just said rearranging the furniture.
My God, the Army's doing it to people that have literally...
Much of the Disney style involves paying attention to details that matter to patients and visitors. Quote, Lafferty noted, if I go to the doctor's office and the plants are dead, I don't have a good feeling.
Well, fuck a bunch of feng shui or whatever the oriental word is for looking out the window the right way. Sorry, gosh.
You're batting 1,000 tonight, David.
Oh, jeez. Lifetime ban is on the way.
The team leader, Donnelly, the one who sizzles,
yeah, right.
Was speaking to the seminar group. I mean, these are people sitting there in white coats with stethoscopes around their necks. These are people...
I know. Oh, God.
These are people sitting there in the Feldgrau, the BDUs or whatever. And Donnelly has the nerve to look at him and says, if you're skeptical right now, that's okay. I am with you.
Oh, yeah, if you're skeptical now... you'll get over it when we tell you you'll get a promotion by shaking your head yes.
And then Lafferty moved into the Lafferty's part of the presentation and discussed the similarities between Disney and the Army Hospital. Both are dedicated to making people feel better. Both are subject to media scrutiny, and both are named after famous people named Walter.
I would love it, and I've met a couple of them. I would be so thrilled if a chain-smoking Army nurse that got out of the Army in 1972 after 8 years of glorious service could sit down across a bottle of scotch with these assholes and explain it to them. Think about that.
Well, let's go to a quick TV metaphor. Can you imagine trying to pull this off with a Margaret Houlihan?
Wouldn't last 5 seconds.
Oh, this thing is just a real crap sandwich, David. It just piles on and on and on. The Walter Reed people, who apparently have been, you know, when you bring somebody in like this, you have deemed that your people are your problem. In other words, it's a way of avoid. It's like the drunk who says, you know, it's not me, it's the booze.
Yep. Right. Yeah. Uh huh.
The Walter Reed employees learned the Disney lexicon. Employees are called cast members. Customers or patients are guests.
Oh, yeah, all right. Screw the euphemism. You know, never mind associates, employees. Never mind guests, they're patients. They're damaged goods. It's somebody's job to bring these people back to something resembling the way they were before they got their ass shot off. Come on, America.
A wheelchair with frayed padding on the armrests leaves a lasting impression, Donnelly said.
Oh, well, let's just tidy up the details, straighten the pictures, and paint the walls, and the guys with no legs will never notice. Well, glory.
I'm trying to think. Jesus, I'm glad I don't have any Disney music loaded in, because I'd be doing something real smart alecky, like loading the Circle of Life or... David, I got to roll.
Well, cheers, mate. See ya.
Bye now. Does that get under your skin as much as it does mine? If it does, we'll talk about it tomorrow night, okay? Because right now, on the way, the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio program, Strictly Confidential, with your host, Peter Godbold, all mended up and on the well and rocking and rolling and itching, I tell you, to turn the microphone on and bring you another couple of hours of the nation's only five-night-a-week LGBT conversation radio program. Many thanks tonight to Peter Godbold, who, in addition to being the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, is also our IT consultant. Our chief engineer in Sydney, Australia, is John Fox. Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org makes sure the streams do what streams are supposed to do and maintains the archives and podcasting as well. All the shows on the Horn are brought to you in part by the dedicated, hardworking folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Bobby. evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome. Welcome indeed to book, chapter, and verse 120 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network. Also brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's crmw.net. Please stop by crmw.net and visit the good folks over at Coal River Mountain Watch. We'll be glad you did. We appreciate their support. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, February 28th, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Thursday evening, that is February the 28th, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you are more than welcome to call in and talk to myself and to the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. I'll be giving out those telephone numbers in just a moment. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the guest sites and to the guest audio archives if you've missed a show that you'd like to hear. You'll find links to the chat room, which is active as I speak. And as with all of the Head-On Radio Network programming, the chat room is an integrated part. It's integral to the shows. You are indeed missing a lot if you are not in our chat room. If you are listening on a replay stream or one of the audio archives, of course, you're not able to get in the chat room. But we appreciate your listening just the same. At strictlyconfidentialradio.com, you're going to find links to the main Head-On Radio Network site. And there you'll find information about all of the other progressive programming on the Head-On Radio Network, of which I'm only a very small part and very proud to be a part. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com also for the MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. We're missing Bob this evening. We hope that he is back soon. Bob is involved in a meeting that are prearranged introduction. He'll tell us about it, no doubt, on the horn section, which will be following Strictly Confidential. So it's always a surprise. When Bob's show runs, of course, I'm listening to the audio of Bob's show in my headphones, and then Bob's show fades out, and Strictly Confidential theme begins running. However, when Bob is not there, I'm listening to Total Silence, and all of a sudden, bang, here comes the theme song. It's always quite a little shock when Strictly Confidential starts and you realize that you have come down to the last minute and down to the wire. It's always nice to have Bob there to sort of ease us in. I'm so pleased to have our guest this evening. Agnes is attempting to reach the guest now. Our guest is DJ Rick Ashman. I'm sorry, Ashman. Now, Rick is from Seattle, and lives in Seattle. Rick was introduced to us by way of our dear friend VJC, or Victor. You know Victor from having been on the show in the past, an amazing interview. It was back in November, I believe. If you click on the November calendar, you can go back and hear that. We also know Victor for the Gay Bar Across the Street segments that he has been doing. We asked him to send us in some new segments this evening because we've run low. They're very popular here, so we're glad to have Victor sending us some more Gay Bar Across the Street mix sets. And we'll probably have Victor back into the rotation next week. In fact, I'm sure we will if he has time to prepare some new tracks.